up, everyone? Welcome to the Built on Purpose podcast, where each episode I interview exceptional leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, philosophers, and some straight-up interesting people to explore their outlook on life, work, and leadership. My name is Brian Moore, co-founder and managing partner of Y Scouts, and today I'm interviewing Brian Walker, the chief executive officer at Herman Miller. Most of you are likely familiar with Herman Miller because of the success of the Aeron chair. In fact, you might be sitting on one right now. A deeper dive into the world of Herman Miller reveals a very, very special story, actually quite a few of them. In this really engaging conversation Brian and I had, and by the way, Brian's been the CEO of Herman Miller since 2004, we touch on a variety of topics, just a few of them. Some of the high-impact leadership lessons that Brian learned at a very, very early age through his involvement in youth sports. Brian's real deep, deep focus on always taking advantage of the experiences life has to offer and an emphasis around spending time with people, which is interesting because Brian comes from the accounting and finance world prior to taking over as CEO of Herman Miller. Another topic we touch on and a great story around how it's really easy for leadership teams to reject the feedback from their employees until the leadership team is actually a part of that firsthand experience and maybe losing a deal. And Brian shares a great story about how this came about and the importance of staying in front of the customer. So this is a great area that just a great story on that. We touch on how important it is to keep the lines of communication open within an organization, especially as it grows larger. You know, the best ideas can bubble up from those who may absolutely surprise you. And this notion that everyone on your team has a special gift if you just pay attention. And of course, as you might imagine, given that Brian is the CEO of Herman Miller, talking about the power of design in the workplace and the impact that it has on people and how we've moved from the Industrial Revolution where work was designed in a linear fashion to the world we live in today, the knowledge economy, where serendipity really rules. So some great stuff there. And finally, this notion, Herman Miller being a publicly traded organization and how Brian and the leadership team and their board really balance the need of all of their stakeholders and ensuring that they're building something from a long-term perspective to be successful, and some great advice around that. So just a ton of nuggets in this one. Herman Miller, an incredibly well-known organization. Brian Walker, I bring you a great, great interview conversation with him. Enjoy it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am so thrilled to be welcoming Brian Walker, the CEO of Herman Miller, to the Built on Purpose podcast show. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
So, you know, obviously I want to get into you being the chief executive officer of, without question, the most well-known office furniture company that's out there. But where I'd love to start, I want to get into a little bit about you. Maybe you could share with us where you grew up.
I grew up in a little city in kind of central Michigan called Jackson. It's not really known for much today other than prisons and hospitals, which is kind of a weird combination. But grew up there. It's been a long time since I lived there. Mom and Dad's still there. Dad was a heavy equipment operator in the Operating Engineers Union for 50 years. My mom was a telephone operator. They were kind of those old American stories, married at 16. Really did a great job of being good savers and doing all the things that I think the country stands for.
Sounds like a bit of that good old Midwest set of values and work ethic is what I'm hearing as well.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
I'm curious, during your childhood or more formative years, was there any defining moment for you that you think really perhaps altered or changed the course of what your life was going to look like? Anything jump to mind?
Yeah, I mean, there was actually, I can point to several. Like, I suppose the first one, you know, that really jumped out at me is kind of funny. I played Little League football for many years, and we had a team that was kind of like the Bad News Bears, if you remember that movie. We
were sure.
Particularly good. We were kind of a ragtag bunch, and we had a tendency to fight more than we played. And our last year we could play together, we all got together over the summer and said, hey, look, we ought to try to win this thing. And I remember one of my big jobs that summer was I got the guys together every week. We practiced, actually ran plays, and you know, this is seventh graders, right? Which is not like we were high school or anything. And we literally organized ourselves. By the time the coaches showed up in the fall, we'd already been practicing for 4 or 5 weeks running plays. We kind of knew who was where. And we went on and did really well. And I think that was sort of my first, you know, maybe my first foray into leadership where, you know, I sort of rallied the group around, even though I had no real, had no positional authority. But I got them enthusiastic enough, and we all went on to tie for the city championship after a team that had, I don't think we'd ever had a winning season in my, you know, many years with that group. That's probably that I think still sticks in my mind as one of those stories of, you know, from your childhood. Probably the next big one for me was when I graduated from high school. I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. Didn't know if I was going to go on to college or what I was going to do, even though I was a decent student. And I had this plan. I was going to leave and go out and work on the loading docks in Seattle where my brother lived. And I was going with my cousin. And later in the summer, he met a girl and decided he wasn't going. And so I ended up, you know, sitting down with my dad, and he looked at me and said, listen, you get two choices. You can figure out how to pay for yourself to go to school, or you can move out and get a job, but you're not going to live here without trying to do something. And it was actually, you know, I remember that as like a real watershed, because from that point on, I went to school with a couple of years to a junior college and off to Michigan State. And I was a non-traditional student because I was really working pretty much full time and going to school, and that really changed my whole sort of outlook on what I wanted to do and what I saw about as my purpose. And that, I, you know, those two things really stick out to me, both of those.
Those are great examples. Thanks for sharing. You know, I'm curious. I have actually a question on each of those examples to dive a little deeper. You know, as you think back to that seventh grade football story and you taking a leadership role without any of the authority, as you called it, do you know what possessed you to reach out to your teammates and actually do that as you think back? I mean, that's a lot of maturity and leadership, as you pointed out, for someone, you know, in the seventh grade. That's early.
You know, I think probably that has come through over and over again since then of being having a very high level of competitive spirit. and you know, I went on to do martial arts for many years, and I taught, and I think I was sort of a natural teacher. I love to teach, but I'd like to teach to compete is the way I would describe it. And I think that's informed not only, you know, what I did when I was a martial arts instructor to the way that I've approached my working career. I think most people would say, hey, he's a pretty tough boss, but you can always count on the fact that he's always trying through things to teach you something about it, not just give you an answer. And I think that sort of was probably started as an early thing.
How early in your life did you start in martial arts?
Well, actually, funny enough, so the year after the football story, there was no organized sports in Jackson. They had eliminated middle school sports altogether in a budget crisis back in the 70s. And so I was standing around with not much to do, and my sister was a gymnast, and she had an idea that karate would be good for her as a gymnast. And so I went with her to go one time to check it out, and she lasted 2 weeks, and I was there for 25 years. So,
wow,
very, very early. I spent most of my high school and college life. I spent, you know, probably if I wasn't at work or at school, my waking hours were usually in a karate school somewhere.
Wow. I'd love to stay on this topic. I have a feeling we could probably just go down the martial arts rabbit hole and the philosophies that I'm sure are still you hold near and dear in the way you lead today. The second question that I wanted to ask, as you were talking about your college career, you somewhat nonchalantly said you found your purpose. And I'm curious if you could share, you know, was there a moment that you recall exactly recognizing what it is you were called to do or were planning to do
after or during that college experience, and what has led you to today?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I worked, like I say, through my, I worked pretty much full time through college and high school, and I think probably along my sort of junior year in college, I realized that I just had a real interest and thirst for business, and that the idea of creating great products and services that helped people do what they did better became sort of a real interest at a personal level. I mean, I went on to become an accountant, and I loved being out with clients, and I realized that I really just enjoyed listening to what they were doing and how they were thinking about business models and business problems, and sort of became a student of that stuff. And, you know, I think it was a bit of an awakening, you know, sort of between my sophomore and junior year that I didn't want to just have a job. I actually wanted to go out and make a difference.
I mean, that's, I think there's, I meet lots of people doing the work that I do who assume that the wisdom that's passed down, you know, go get a job, or go to high school, get a degree, go to college, get a degree, go get a job, work your way up the corporate ladder, and just continue to climb without any real vision for where it is you're climbing to. And it sounds like you were incredibly lucky in recognizing creating impact and wanting to do something with meaning much earlier on than most. I would say that that you're incredibly lucky in that regard.
Well, and you know, it's funny in some ways that maybe that I would also say, though, I really didn't have any, people always ask me about what goals or what was your career, but I didn't really have goals around, you know, becoming a CEO or a chief financial. None of that stuff really ever rang true to me. I really liked experiences and I liked people. And I don't know if I would have recognized that at the time, by the way. This is one of those easy to see it, you know, in from the vantage point of looking backwards, you
sure.
can see it, that, you know, my energy came from being around people solving problems. And I think at the time, though, it wasn't targeted towards, hey, let's go get the big job. It was, hey, let's go have some great fun and get around people. And I realized that in some ways business was a lot like sports, that, you know, you had to get a team together. You had to have a clear objective. And leadership didn't always mean positional authority. It meant who had the willingness and the enthusiasm to step out front and try to move the group forward. And so I think there was a lot of parallels between those things.
That's great. That's really great. You know, it's interesting. You obviously started your career, as you shared, with numbers and finance and accounting. Yet you've repeatedly said, and we've only been chatting for a couple of minutes, about really appreciating experiences and people. And I think for many, perhaps unjustified, but there's the stereotype that many professionals in the finance and accounting realm are far more introverted, far more analytical. Not that either of those are a bad thing, but usually being analytical, introverted, spending time with the numbers on the finance and accounting side don't always lend itself to having that same level of appreciation for experiences in people. So perhaps in a way, maybe you're an anomaly. Do you ever think about that?
Well, I would actually say to you, I think we're kind of lucky and maybe blessed, Aaron Miller, that we've got, we've had a lot of people with financial backgrounds who I would say were sort of ambidextrous, that they both, you know, got the people side and had an interest in, you know, have an interest in the design side of the business. And that maybe that's one of the great advantages of being at this company in some ways, is I think our chairman and I often say, you know, if you're at Herman Miller for very long, it'll probably change you more than you'll change it. And so I think in some ways, maybe a lot of these things were innate. But I also think they become learned over time if you're around a culture that, you know, asks you to do more than what's within your, you know, maybe your area of responsibility. And I got really fortunate early in my time at Herman Miller, and even when I was at Arthur Andersen, of people who pushed me to think outside of my current responsibilities or area. And I can remember a client when I was very young at Arthur Anderson who would take me out to dinner, and I don't know why it globbed onto me, and he would sit and just talk to me about business things and ask me things if I thought about them. And he would actually ask my opinion on things in his business that I had really, to be frank, no business answering. But it became really, I think, one of those self-reinforcing things that he constantly said, hey, look, I'm just going to encourage you because I think you've got a brain to think about this stuff. Don't be afraid to ask or to get involved in things that are outside of your realm because that's where your learning is going to come from. And I suppose it's that sort of thirst for learning and experiences that enables you to get outside of your own stuff. And I think Herman Miller as a culture has always had a very big willingness to move people, sort of horizontally between things rather than feeling you were stuck on a straight ladder. And I benefited greatly from that.
You know, I think that's a great track I want to stay on for a moment, this spirit of relentless learning. In a recent interview, actually in a series of interviews that I was able to read in preparation for our chat today, you know, you as the CEO of a pretty decent sized organization, you still make time and quite a bit of time to stay out in front with the customers that you serve. Can you talk a little bit about, was it an epiphany you had during a downturn, or was this just your general DNA that you recognized how important it would be to always be out, you know, quote unquote, working deals so that you can stay in touch with what's actually happening in the market?
You know, I think that early on, I worked a lot with a gentleman named Bill Mitchell, got our Asian business started. And I traveled a lot with Bill and watched Bill carefully as he navigated building a business and realizing that he always was involved in at one level or another around the customer interface, because he believed it gave him better knowledge about what to do in the business. That was a really good learning for me. I would say when I first was running our North American business, we went through a very significant downturn where the business almost was cut in half over a very short period of time on the other side of the dot-com bubble. And I can remember vividly on a long bicycle ride one day after my wife told me that I should go for a ride and come back with a better attitude.
There's a good story there.
I was riding my bicycle into a big headwind, and I was thinking about a gentleman who we had acquired his business a few years before, who I always thought of as a really great entrepreneur. And I was thinking to myself, what would he do, versus, sometimes we get all woe is me. I started asking myself, what would he do? And I said, well, I know what he'd do. He'd go out and meet with customers. And I literally came back from that ride and called my team together the next week and said, okay, this is right before Thanksgiving. I said, you guys now all have through Christmas, but after Christmas, every executive is going to be assigned to a sales territory. And I want you to spend 2 to 3 weeks a month out in the field, not only with customers, but with dealers and salespeople, because we got to figure out in a much more personal way what is getting in the way of us on any opportunity that's possible, because there aren't that many opportunities and we have to be able to move faster. And it was eye-opening, and one of those lessons that I think I've probably learned a couple of times now, that it's really easy to reject the feedback of your organization about what is in their way and what they're not getting done until you have to own with them the result. And so when you walk into or out of a customer presentation realizing you lost and there's something you didn't have or wasn't available to the team that's in the field, when you're part of the loss, you get very focused on what it's going to take to not have that happen again. Versus when they come back and tell you they lost, it's really easy to say, well, I'm sure it was for some other reason. And so I think my learning has been that at least in our business, executives need to be very connected to the front end of the business and on a day-by-day basis and learning directly with clients and dealers. And it's the only way I think we can be as quick as we need to be and as open to the way things are changing. And I think in today's world where business is changing so rapidly, being connected with the front end and feeling like you're learning every day is the only way to stay up with it.
I mean, what a great, great nugget of wisdom there in owning the loss or being a part of the loss. Not that you're encouraging anyone out, regardless of industry, to go lose, but to have the leadership team experience the heartbreak of trying and not winning and, you know, internalizing that as opposed to just hearing from the team sharing, you know, what might otherwise be perceived as, you know, excuses or whatever the case may be. I think that's a really, really valuable lesson. I'm curious, when you came back from that bike ride and you shared with your leadership team and assigning each of them a sales territory and wanting them to spend a good chunk of every month after the holidays, did you get any pushback? Did any of your team think that this isn't a good idea?
There was pushback. You know, I'll give you an example. The gentleman who at the time ran our what we call people services, you know, he looked at me like, so I'm the head of people services, if you will. Some people might call it human resources, and I'm going to be out selling. And by the way, not only was he sort of taken back, but you imagine the territory who got assigned the HR guy to come out and help him with projects.
Sure.
They literally called me and said, I mean, are you serious? That's who you're sending us? And they thought, to be frank, he would be an anchor. And he went out and became a huge student of how did the sales process work. And turns out he's one of the most well-read people I know, super thoughtful guy. And customers liked being around him because he was super thoughtful. And in the end, what we're doing for our customers is helping them create places that enable their culture to do more. What better person to have out there than the guy who has to do that for Herman Miller? So when he's talking about the offices and the space, he's also talking about what we have to do culturally. So it turned out he became a super effective sales contributor and now runs our entire international business. And by the way, he's become a good student of product and a bunch of other things that came out of it. And in fact, you know, the sales team in the end, I couldn't make enough of his time for people, and there was multiple regions calling asking for more of his time. And he's sort of my perfect example of, you never know who's going to be a great salesperson, and having him become a student meant that, you know, even things that they might have gotten, we may have gotten in the way from a policy perspective, if you will, within people services for the field sales group, suddenly he was a good student of what needed to be done. So we had a lot of pushback. And then I think the entire team would say post that, wow, did we get better as a group about really understanding what was going on in our own business? That may seem trite, but it's easy to get left with thinking about the next big thing. And you're doing it by your own supposition versus as, you know, the folks in Toyota would say, doing a go and see. And in some ways, that's what the advantage of being out in the field is. It's a go and see. You hear every day up close and personal from your customers about why they are or are not buying your products. And I think whenever I find us in a period when it doesn't feel like we're operating at our peak, my first reaction now is we're not spending enough time with customers. And the more we do that, the faster we learn.
That's what a great example. Thanks for sharing that. I want to let's go back in history for a moment. And the Herman Miller founder, DJ Dupree, said, and I quote, "A business is rightly judged by its products and services, but it must also face scrutiny as to its humanity." This is a pretty profound quote, in my opinion, and this is not a quote that was made 5 years ago. This is a quote that was made early in the 20th century by the Herman Miller founder. How much is DJ Dupree's overall just presence and humanity? How much is it still alive? How much of it's still alive today? How do you see it? Do you feel it? Talk to me about this sense of humanity that exists in Herman Miller.
I think the short answer is DJ's spirit is very much at the center of what makes Herman Miller tick. One of my current real pushes around the company is, we're going to manage by principles, not by policy. And in fact, my little short thing is policies are for managers, principles are for leaders, and we don't need managers. We need lots of leaders. And I think much of what DJ talked about, when you see that writing on the wall, it was about being very principled about what you thought about people and what you thought about those people's position in the world were and their impact. From how do you think about the environment? I often say I think one of the things DJ did, he was way ahead of his time around concepts like transparency and around diversity. Now, he wouldn't have used any of those terms the way we do today. He wouldn't have talked about green. He wouldn't have talked about diversity. But his actions really were all centered around the belief that all individuals were special and that if you could tap into what made them special, you would go way further than if you tried to keep them into some, little organizational box. And, whenever folks come to Herman Miller, they often say, well, I'm surprised that, even the folks on the shop floor, man, they look like they're working really hard, but people are smiling. And we always say, yeah, that's sort of the secret sauce, is that, we don't get it all right. And it's, it's hard work and we're struggling every day to keep up with the demands on us. On the other hand, I do think we try every day to live up to what his spirit was around humanity.
The corporate mission of Herman Miller, a corporate purpose, is inspiring designs to help people do great things. And I hope I said that appropriately or I got it right. How long ago was this corporate mission, this corporate purpose born?
Well, we really codified it probably 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. I'd say, the reason it felt so natural is I think that's been at the heart of the company for probably its entire existence. And we'd often say it's a bit of a duality. Part of what DJ put the company on a path to do was to find great authors, in this case, designers, who would bring him their best ideas. And he believed they'd do that because he would abandon himself to their creativity. That's a little unique because most companies go out and say, I want you to design one of these. DJ would come out and say, I want to have great relationships with people who will bring us their best ideas. And if you bring us your best ideas, we will abandon ourselves to making your idea come to life. And so I think, part of the duality here is how do we inspire people to do great design? The other thing is how do we make sure that our products are inspiring to the users, whether that is they're just so beautiful that they make you feel better, or whether that is they're inspiring because you're more comfortable, so therefore you're able to do more important work in a better way. So we see it as both of those, that we want to constantly be nurturing the design and creative element of society to bring us great ideas and to see us as a conduit for them.
You know, it's been said that we end up as adults spending 2/3 of our adult life at this thing we refer to as work. Do you think companies today, whether they're for-profit, non-profit, big, small, do you think companies today and the leaders at companies today still underestimate or undervalue the power of design and how they create where we end up spending all of this time as members of organizations?
I think the answer to that is yes. There are clearly organizations who get it. But if you think about it, in some ways, what we did in the 80s and 90s, in some ways, we organized more and more our knowledge people in the same way we thought about factories. We set everybody up in sort of linear fashion across departments to move work from place to place. Yet we know that most knowledge work is best done in a way that is not linear, but in fact is more serendipitous and bouncing around. That's where the real power comes from. And so I think there's a bit of a revolution happening today that our young people, I think, have been maybe lucky and fortunate that by the way technology has evolved, we've almost come full circle to the days when, you know, our brainstorming happened, back in the 60s before computers. When people got together, they had to really think about things and write them down and spend time as a group talking through them. So then over time, we became sort of slaves to one particular place to sit and stare at a tube. We're now again today, in some ways, whether that's digitally or sort of face-to-face organically, we see that coming back around again. So we believe the best companies recognize this need to create culture through place, and that culture ultimately is what will drive the innovation they need to compete. And you can see this at, you know, places like, you know, Facebook, whether you love exactly how their culture portrays it, you're seeing companies that realize that it's important that the places that they're at are sort of strange attractors for the talent that they need. And I think some people still see their places as a cost center rather than as an asset. And I think the companies that are going to win the war for talent going forward, and there are some great examples around the world, like Commonwealth Bank in Australia is completely fixated on that their places that they have are one of their most valuable assets for not only attracting people, but for helping their people be as productive as possible. And that's in some ways, the opposite of what most of us think. And that's not by controlling them and telling them where they need to be, but by creating spaces that they absolutely want to be there because they find the other people that are there inspiring to them as well.
You know, it's so interesting. There's been a lot of talk around the growing presence of, you know, the virtual workforce. And you know, it's certainly not talk. There's many people, you walk into any coffee shop in any town in America, and you're going to find somebody sitting there with a laptop open and connected to a headset doing work. And with so much of the workforce at least appearing to be far more flexible than it's ever been, I'm curious, do you fear that companies are going to begin investing less in their place and using place as part of culture as a competitive advantage because of this virtual nature of work? Or do you feel that that's just not, at the end of the day, in order to truly build culture, you actually do need a home base or a place, and a place that's representative of the type of culture that you want to build?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, there's no doubt that it's hard to paint one singular brush because all of us probably work in multiple places today, whether you stay at home because you need something that you need to get done, that you need to concentrate, that's easier to do there, or you know, you're on the road and, you know, you got 10 minutes and you want to get some stuff done, so you pop into Starbucks. So I think the idea that we're going to work in an untethered way in multiple locations, that's just the reality of modern life. However, I think it's interesting to me that whenever folks say, hey, this work can be done anywhere, so And because things are being done much more and more and sort of over social networks, we don't all need to be in the same place. I guess I look and I go back and I say, but the most socially dynamic companies that are creating that technology, whether that's Facebook, Google, or Apple, as just three examples, what are they all doing as we speak? Reinvesting in corporate campuses. And what they realize is that while all the technology is great, the stickiness comes from people. And, you know, there's an old study that was once done many years ago around churches where they found if you went to a church, if you didn't meet somebody in your first two or three visits who you developed a relationship with, chances are you didn't stay in. You went to a different church. And I think companies have exactly that same challenge. That in some ways, we're all social beings, and the places we work are no different than the places we join, like country clubs. That I think people really join companies because they believe that that is a place that reflects them and their values. And that's why I think if you take this full circle, in some ways, I think business leaders who see where the world is going will spend as much of their time saying, am I creating a social culture that's attractive to the kind of people I need to get the work done that I have, as much as they will asking, do they have the right technical capabilities to get the work done? So I don't fear the idea of mobility. I think it's inevitable. I think that there are opportunities to potentially get more utility out of the space we all have today by embracing the mobility. But at the same time, one of the things you should be nervous about is if your people believe that they're more productive or happier someplace other than your places, that should make you very nervous and probably tell you that's somebody you're about to lose.
That's a great, great point. That's a great point. You know, your comment around the church example, you know, the likelihood of somebody continuing to show up if they're not meeting other people within the first two or three trips, to me is just very resonant in that, you know, the Gallup organization, who's fairly well known for their work around employee engagement, among other things, you know, they've got their annual Q12 survey. And I recall hearing that probably the lead indicator of engagement is whether or not an employee has a best friend at work. And that's hard to get to that level if you don't have a place to go to that's engaging, inspiring, where obviously you're going to have those collisions with other people to build those relationships. So that really resonates with me. I want to talk about the greenhouse, your corporate campus. And I believe it was in 95, if my memory serves, that you opened it, the office in Holland, Michigan. And something that just, I think this is fascinating for me. I was on a flight back from Austin, Texas, not too long ago, and got into a very engaging conversation with the person sitting next to me about the issues that's happening right now with the world's bee population. And I couldn't help but just find the serendipity in learning about your greenhouse that when you guys moved in, you invited some new friends and hundreds of thousands, I think 600,000-700,000 bees living in 12 hives. And you're actually bottling the honey from these bees and using it as a token of appreciation for all of your stakeholders. Share just a little bit about how this thing came to be, all puns intended. How did this come about?
Well, in some ways, this is a great connection back to DJ and his belief that, you know, everybody has a special gift, and sometimes we just miss those gifts. So we built, when we built the greenhouse, which is now the main facility where we produce our seeding, when we built the greenhouse, one of the things, it was actually a pioneer building for the LEED system around, you know, sustainable buildings. And the architect was Bill McDonough, and Bill really helped with that building to set the stage for what we've now seen in, you know, lots of not only corporate America, but globally around buildings that are much more sustainable and live more happily with the environment. And one of the things Bill and the team decided was rather than building, you know, developing lush lawn landscapes that needed to be mowed, was that we would use the natural wildflowers from the area that would be sort of very low maintenance, which was great, but also would be very much in keeping with the natural terrain. It's a brilliant idea. It looks beautiful, inexpensive to maintain. Didn't take any water because you don't have to water most of those wildflowers. The negative turned out to be that in those flowers, we got a bunch of paper wasps who had a tendency to attack the people getting out of their cars. And so suddenly we have this new building that's really beautiful and all these flowers, and people are getting attacked, getting in and out of their cars. And the question became, what should we do? And of course, the initial response, like we normally do, is, well, we'll get a, you know, a guy out here who's a pest control guy, and we'll use some pesticides, and we can get rid of all this stuff. Well, it turned out we had a guy that worked in our facilities group who happened to be a beekeeper on the side. And he knew that one of the natural enemies of the wasp was actually the honeybee. And so he came up with the idea and sold it to the team that we would actually plant honeybees on the property, which would chase off the wasp. We would have to use no pesticides. And the byproduct was we have our own honey that we can bottle and give to our guests. So one of those kind of win-win-wins. And I think maybe what's most important about that story is the fact that here's a guy that nobody knew was a beekeeper. And we saw him as, you know, a member of the facilities team. And we didn't start off by asking him what to do about it. But he luckily put his head up above and said, hey, I got a better idea. And to me, the lesson in all that is our need to always be looking beyond the jobs that our people have or what's on their resume to see what are the other things that they do and care about that can add value in ways that are really surprising to us.
That is an excellent, excellent backstory. You know, and I think in order for something like that to manifest, there has to be an environment in which communication, both up, down, across, left, right, back, forth, is really embraced and celebrated. And so I would have to assume for a member of the facilities team to just lift up and say, hey, I've got an idea. You know, that only happens when there's a real spirit of open, honest, you know, radically transparent communication that serves as a foundation of the organization. I have to assume that you're a living example of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we try very hard to keep all those, I'll call them informal lines of communication open. And I think, you know, even I have a very clear, you know, sort of policy in my own that says, if you send me a note, you will hear back from me personally. So I don't care whether you're a customer who has a problem with a caster on your chair or says, I got a problem, or you're a guy on the shop floor. If you've got an issue and you raise it, all then it gets all the way to me, you can count on the fact I'm going to come and talk to you about it. And I think that sort of sets the tone that everybody should be open enough to say, hey, talk to me. You know, I'm sure that people say, well, he's not that easy to get to at times because I don't see him that often. And that's true. On the other hand, I think you have to sort of create that spirit of, hey, we're out in the open. In fact, my team sits very much out in the open in one of our buildings. And that's partially why we do it, is so that we get a chance to get those, you know, serendipitous exchanges where people, you know, bring us an idea without fear that it's going to be completely let go of before somebody's given it a hearing. And to me, that is sort of at the core of the spirit of the company, is that, you know, we're open to ideas. Bring us your crazy ideas. We'll take a look at them. And if we think they work, we'll follow them. It doesn't matter what your background is or where you're from. We're just open to ideas.
You know, one of the comments you just made to this point around, you know, maybe you're not always the easiest guy to get a hold of. You obviously have lots of stakeholders that, you know, you need to balance the needs of. And clearly one of those stakeholders is your shareholders. Herman Miller is a publicly traded organization. And there's been much made about the demands of Wall Street, the demands of shareholders, and consistently delivering results on a relatively short-term basis, quarterly results. How do you balance the needs of your shareholders while really paying attention to the needs of all of your stakeholders, your communities, your employees, your suppliers, your vendors? You know, how do you do that? Because I'm not a CEO of a publicly traded company, and it's got to be difficult.
Well, you know, I think in some ways, at times I'd almost argue there are clearly examples where people get that picture out of balance, and we can all talk about the cases we've seen in the last 20 years in corporate America where, you know, people went after the sort of shortcut route to produce financial results that ended up blowing up. And I think in almost all cases, those things ultimately get exposed if you're not balancing those things right. And then I'd say we're no different than anyone else. I mean, we have a lot of conversations about, do we have the balance right? Because in the end, you know, we always say we have a moral obligation to provide a return to our shareholders because they entrusted us with their funds. So no different than, I think we have a moral obligation to make sure that our employees go home every day safe. I think we have a moral obligation to our local communities and maybe even our global communities where we're borrowing their resources to make sure that we're good stewards of those resources in a way that they'll be here for the next generation. I don't think it's that hard if you simply say, you know, if this were my children, if it were my, you know, how would I want them treated? Sometimes I think we over dramatize it, and we won't get it right. We make mistakes all the time. And, you know, what we try to say is ultimately we have to take care of our people first, because if we don't have great people, we can't take care of customers well. And then we have to really take care of our customers really well, because if we don't take care of our customers, we won't be able to make a return for our investors. And so, you know, many years ago, I was asked this question and I said, well, I think, you know, I don't know if there's an order, you got to keep them all in balance. And then I was listening to the gentleman who ran and founded Southwest Airlines, and he talked to me, oh, there is an order. And I think in retrospect, I think he's right. I think there has to be a bit of an order that you do have to take care of your people first, because they take care of your customers. Then you have to take care of your customers. Your shareholders, they don't come last in terms of importance, but really they're an outcome of doing the other things well. And I think that's also true if you put, you know, the environment and your local community into that overall thing. If your job is not to lead for 5 years, but your job is to build an organization, an institution that lasts multiple generations, if you're not a good steward, eventually there will be a cost to society that every company will bear, whether that's bear it through higher costs or higher levels of regulation. I mean, we can see that today, even with, you know, all of the financial shenanigans that happened, if, you know, with the WorldComs of the world and all of that, and maybe even through the financial crisis, we know there is an additional cost today that we are all bearing for some folks' immoral activity around what they were doing. And we all feel the extra burden of new regulation to go do that. So I think if you keep asking yourself, how am I going to rise above to lead with a sense of purpose and principles, that it isn't that hard really to balance those things. And, you know, while Wall Street really wants their quarterly numbers, really in the end, they too don't value just on the quarter. If you have one, you know, great quarter, but as a result of that, you lose your best talent, and 2 years from now, you can't produce. I guarantee you the value won't be there 2 years from now. So I don't think even they really expect people to do it. I just think at times, because you do feel the pressure of you gotta stand up and show it to somebody, there are times that people, I think, get tempted to not keep those things in the right balance and perspective.
You know, it reminds me, this topic of conversation reminds me of a quote that I heard just recently by Thomas Perez, who is the U.S. Department of Labor Secretary. And he said, and I quote, "Shareholders are best served when stakeholders are well served." And I thought it was just such an appropriate quote, and to me is completely aligned with what you just shared.
I think that's right on. That's actually a very good summary.
Yeah, really, really.
He's better at being pithy than me.
Well, that was that quote came out of a 45-minute keynote that I was lucky enough to witness in person. So I've got the advantage of only pulling the highlights from it. You know, you've been so gracious, Brian, with your time, and I really appreciate it. And I want to wrap up here out of respect for everything that you've got going on. You know, you've been the CEO now of Herman Miller for, you know, a decade plus, and, you know, it certainly doesn't appear to be any signs of that ceasing. Do you think about legacy for you personally? Is that something that creeps into your mindset?
Yeah, I think more so now than, you know, I think it's maybe the curse of getting older is you start to be more reflective and realizing that in the end, what you leave behind for the next group is super important. Whereas I think when you're younger and you're worried about, you know, all you can see is forward, you can't see backwards, that you can't help but ask those questions about, hey, what's my mark? Did I do the right thing? And I think particularly with a company like Herman Miller that has such a great legacy and, you know, an amazing group of former leaders who are, you know, it's such a high level that you want to measure up.
I love it. I love it. There's so much going on at Herman Miller right now. And I would encourage all of our listeners to go to HermanMiller.com and just poke around a bit. There's some amazing information about what Herman Miller is up to. I think for those of you out there that are interested in what's happening in the workplace and the future of work, Herman Miller is an important, important voice that needs to be listened to. You have invested tremendously in research. You work with some of the world's greatest designers, and you know the impact that you are creating in creating, you know, this living office and creating a sense of prosperity for everybody, I think is really important. So I just encourage everybody out there to visit HermanMiller.com and dig around a little bit. I think you'd be pretty fascinated with what Brian and the team are up to. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate this. This was a great conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed hearing our interview with Brian. If you're interested in a transcribed version of this show or want to listen to more episodes of the Built on Purpose podcast, please visit yscouts.com/podcast. Also, if there's someone you'd like to recommend as a guest for the show, drop me a line, brian@yscouts.com. I promise more great interviews are on the way. Thanks again for listening.